All right, we welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals today. We have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket and then one case on our 10:30 docket. So we will probably take a break between those two sets of times. Like I said, we welcome you here. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel. To my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Judge Terry Livingston. I understand you've checked in, and I've got your times to argue, and I believe we'll be starting then with Mr. Bobo in Leslie Bell versus Guilfoyle, cause number 216031 CV.
Thank you, Your Honor. Greg, good to see all of you all again. Justice Pittman, first time I've seen you out there. It's good to see you. This case, from our perspective, comes down to whether or not an affirmative defense of suicide instruction should have been included in the jury charge. And that revolves around CPRC 93.01. And the defense's entire argument at trial and what they put on and what they closed with was that this young man committed suicide, and therefore defendant should not be held negligence. Now, the problem with including the suicide instruction in this jury charge is there's two reasons I don't think it gets there. The first one is, if you read the statute, it says that it can be a defense if what happens is while, or the cause of action accrues while the person is committing suicide or in the process of committing suicide. In this case, that didn't happen. In this case, the cause of action that we complain of is based on the Texas Penal Code 4613, which was when the defendant gave the minor child the handgun and left it in his possession, saw him putting bullets in it, didn't take it away from him, and all of those things are in the brief. That's when the cause of action accrues. It is not until later that the gun discharges and the child dies. And so I don't think, if you read the statute plainly, it says it has the cause of action accrues at that time, and it didn't happen. It happened several hours afterwards. So I don't think, number one, that you get there on that point. Number two, the statute's really clear where it says if you don't get the instruction either, if the actions of the defendant in whole or in part violated some applicable legal standard. Now, in this case, as the court is aware, the trial court had previously granted a partial motion for summary judgment on one of the Texas Penal Code statutes. That order was never withdrawn. The cases cited by the defendant talk about, well, that was withdrawn or is abrogated. All those cases specifically, if you read those cases, talk about where the trial court actually withdrew that ruling. That never happened in this case, and so that ruling is still out there. So,
well, didn't you just more or less try that by consent, and didn't the trial court say on the record that she thought that there were fact issues that were raised during the course of the trial that maybe she didn't specifically say I withdraw that order, but effectively she said that?
Well, I certainly disagree that it's tried by consent, and that conversation was held when we had moved for directed verdict as to 46.13, all three sections. The conversation back and forth never goes to which specific ones. And more importantly, I think if you go back and read those cases where they talk about it and they analyze that statute and how that works, in all of those cases, the trial court specifically withdrew that prior ruling. So I think that's the difference in this case. I understand the argument, but I still think that's what makes this case different. And again, that was in the context of us moving for directed verdict. And so I don't think that I think there's the issue where you had the finding, but even if you don't have that finding, even if the court says, well, I think it was abrogated or I think it was tried by consent, the statute still gets to the point of, on the affirmative defense under 93.01 that they're trying to get to, they have to prove all the elements of that affirmative defense, all of them, without a doubt. And when you look at everything that was before the court, the only person through the entire case who argued suicide was defense counsel. There's zero evidence of saying the ME didn't find that it was suicide. There's no note. There was no indication that there was
witnesses that testified that they thought he was in a bad situation and a mental state whereby this was not inconsistent with suicide, was not inconsistent to what he was feeling and at that time.
Well, with all due respect, I would disagree with you. I think what the defense counsel did is he picked and choose different testimony and tried to paint a horrible family picture, when in fact, when you go back and you actually read everything that these witnesses said, there's not one of them that said, we thought he was going to commit suicide. Was there issues between a mother and a teenage boy? I've got two teenagers. I mean, welcome to the crowd. That happens. To rise to the level of that there's no doubt that this kid was at the point of suicide, that just doesn't get there. It was an argument made by counsel, but the evidence doesn't get there at all when you read everybody's testimony.
They may not have said they thought he was going to commit suicide, but there was testimony by some that they thought he did commit suicide, correct?
I don't recall that testimony. In fact, when asked specifically, what do you think this was going to happen, everybody said, no, we never thought that would happen. The only person who did say, the child's mother, who had passed away by the time of trial, her ex-husband did say that based on everything he had been told by defense counsel, that he didn't have any other explanation. That's correct. The ex-husband did say that. He's the only one that intimates that. So when you look at everybody else and you look at the fact that there's no doubt that this man brought a handgun to the house, and whether the argument is I gave the handgun to the mom or I gave the handgun to the kid, it's uncontroverted that he brought the handgun over for the child to have it. And even after he brings the handgun over, and even if you believe him that I gave it to mom and mom took control of it, the testimony is after that happens, he sees the child in the garage putting bullets into the chamber of this gun and fiddling with it with another teenager in the garage.
Is that when it became a readily dischargeable firearm? Because when he gave it to him, and under that statute, the definition in that statute, it wasn't a readily dischargeable firearm.
Absolutely, and I think, and that's a very good point, because what his testimony was is I saw him putting bullets into the chamber, bullets were in the chamber, and I told him, because those were 22 longs, those bullets won't fit in that gun. Now, he doesn't take it away from him. He doesn't do anything other than turn around and walk back in the house. And what's interesting is later that night, a 22 long bullet is what was discharged from that handgun. So there is no doubt that when he saw him with the gun, there was a bullet in the chamber, and that gun could fire, because that 22 long is a bullet that fired that ultimately killed the child. So there's no doubt that he violated these statutes. And when you look at the other three, despite the one that shed a summary judgment, it left it in control, left it where he could have possession of it. He testified he was playing with it or fiddling with it. When you go through those penal code statutes, there's no doubt that in all of those, it's hard not to see where you don't find that that was negligence per se. When you look at all the evidence that was presented to the court and there's nothing about suicide, it's hard to come up with, other than counsel for the defense who says, hey, this is what happened, that you get to suicide. And yet, there was instruction on both questions 1 and 2. And we objected to that instruction because it clearly said, in the way the instruction is outlined, I think it is an absolute error for her to have included that in the jury charge based on everything that she had already done and all the evidence before the court that the trial court had heard. And when you look at 91.03, whether you get there when the cause of action accrues or whether when you see in whole or in part, breaches some applicable standard. I just don't think there's any way that the way this statute was crafted, and it, by the way, it prevails over any other law, how that should have been included in this case based on the facts. That's all I have, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bobo. Mr. Ave?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. I'm going to go ahead and address the actual issues raised and in the order they were raised by the appellant in this instance, even though it appears that the oral argument was focused on the third issue, not the first two issues, because I believe, again, that was the thrust of their briefing. Well, the third issue I will touch upon as well, but as the court's aware, there's no doubt this is a tragic case. Whether you live 500 feet or 500 miles away from Sam Bell, there was no winner in this case. No one regrets his death more than Mr. Gelfour, who was his neighbor, his friend, his mentor, and a guest in the house that evening, that tragic evening. But that shared loss that Mr. Gelfour has with the Bell family has nothing to do with the legal liability that Leslie Bell seeks to impose upon him for Sam's death. So what are the three issues that the appellants raise, or Leslie Bell raises here? The first is that question two, which is, and all of the issues raised focus on essentially the second negligence per se issue submitted to the jury, which of course Gelfour insisted throughout trial and in our briefing should never have been submitted in the first place, in addition to the question one, which was a general negligence question. The first issue argued by Bell is that there should have been three independent, separate, and distinct negligence per se submissions to the jury. The second is that the excuse defense that's included in each of those penal statutes should not have been included in the statute. And then the third is this suicide defense that was included in the second issue as well as the first issue. It's a common affirmative defense instruction that is included in both issues in the charge. As to the first two issues, again, number one, we've laid out in our brief why this is not a negligence per se claim, and we raised it as a cross point in our brief that was never responded to. We believe we're substantively, even if it wasn't conceded, which it was on appeal, we believe we're substantively right. Leslie Bell was not in the category of persons the statute was designed to protect. His personal injury claims are not the type of injuries the statute, the wrongful death claims are not the injuries the statute was designed to protect against. And there is, in our opinion, no fair, wise, or, as the statute says, workable way to convert this into a negligence standard. And we see this all the time. We don't submit, and the courts don't condone the submission of a general negligence claim in a car accident, and then a separate issue for running a stop sign, speeding, failure to maintain a lane, to repeat the same charge repeatedly. This simply shouldn't have been submitted this way. But even if it is a negligence per se question, I think the idea that as to issue one and two was preserved by Mr. Bell is simply flat out wrong. In terms of the charge conference, it's black and white, pages 7 through 17 of volume 5 of the record. Judge McCoy goes painstakingly through each one of these issues and asks if there is any objection, and over, and same for all the instructions. And with the sole exception of the suicide affirmative defense, over and over again, the response is, no objection, Your Honor. And that's all the way through to the liability question itself as a part of question two. So the idea that there's some issue that's been preserved here to complain on appeal is simply doesn't hold any water. With respect to question one, were they all put together in a broad form submission? I think to do so would have been, to not submit the broad form would have been counter to the mandate under Rule 277 for a broad form submission. And the biggest problem, I think, or another huge hurdle that can't be overcome here, is Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 44.1. It is simply not possible to possibly show how this probably resulted in an improper judgment to submit these questions as a single liability issue in addition to the overall negligence question. As for the excuse issue two they raised in the brief, the excuse defense, excuse me, under the, all three of these statutes, it either deals with parental consent or deals with parental supervision or 18-year-old supervision. Again, the evidence, we believe, is clear in the record here. The evidence was that Mr. Guilford gave the gun to Sam in the presence of his mother, and that she essentially sanctioned or blessed the gift. Volume 3, reporter's record at 140, 141. Mrs. Dobbs, Sam's mother, thought that the gun was under her bed. And Mr. Guilford's testimony, when he left the house, he again urged Mrs. Dobbs to ensure that the gun was secured and put away. Volume 3, reporter's record 151. So the idea that those statutory excuses should not be, and Judge McCoy addressed this during the charge conference, that there was evident, there was clearly some evidence of these affirmative defenses, was entirely proper for the submission.
The one affirmative defense is only if it's given under supervision and given for sporting, hunting, so forth activities.
Otherwise,
there's no evidence for that this was a gift to be used for sporting or hunting.
And other lawful purposes. And I believe that possession of a gun, and I believe the record is replete with evidence of the boy hunting, the boy being very interested in firearms and regularly using firearms.
Rifles for hunting.
Absolutely. But firearms in general. And he asked for this gun. Mr. Guilford gave him this gun with the blessing of his mother. And I believe that Your Honor, is 100% consistent with a statute that allows for a lawful purpose, because I believe that possession of the gun was 100% lawful, and I believe it was done under the supervision of her parents. So I do not, under the supervision of her mother, so I do not believe that there can be any question whatsoever. And you can also own a pistol like this for the purposes of sporting, because that's exactly what you do with it, is shoot a 22 caliber gun or pistol for the purposes of sporting. And again, that's consistent with the evidence and the testimony about what this boy did as it relates to all firearms in his interest. And so I don't believe the statute is narrowly tailored to consent and supervision for the exclusive purposes of hunting. I don't believe that that's what the statute says or is intended to do. With respect to the suicide defense idea, that it's only available if the suicide happens at the moment you give them the gun, I don't believe it's supported by the statutory language, and I don't believe it's supported by any rational application of the statute. So if this logic is carried to its logical, or if this reasoning is carried to its logical conclusion, then unless the person, the moment you violate the statute, the access provision, 46.13b2, you allow access, unless the suicide happens according to this reasoning, the moment you allow the access, suicide can never be a defense because it didn't happen that moment. In other words, it happened some temporal period after you allowed the access to it, and that simply isn't what the statute says, Chapter 93 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and that can't be the logical intent of it. And I think that looking at the two cases that Bell cites to support this, there's two of them, the Alvarado decision and the Mutrix decision. Neither of them supports her proposition, and I would submit that they support Guilford's position, which is in Alvarado, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals said that it was error to submit the instruction. That was the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court reversed that and did not allow that holding to stand and said, we don't need to get to whether or not it's proper to submit it, because here they can't show any harm. Why? Because the jury found the defendant bore no negligence whatsoever. So therefore, it can't be error. You can't show reversible error. So what's our situation here? It's precisely the exact same scenario that the Supreme Court said there can't be reversible error in that scenario, because the jury in this instance found that Mr. Guilford bore no legal responsibility.
How do we know that, really? Because this is my concern. Under the Civil Practices and Remedies Code, it says that if suicide caused in whole or part by failure of defendant to comply with legal standard, suicide shall not be a defense. So the way these two questions were worded, the jury found one of two things, and I don't see how you can come to the conclusion that they found one over the other. Either they found there was no violation of a standard of care, or under the instruction as it was given, they found that there was a violation of the standard of care, but the defense kicked in. But we don't know which one they found, do we?
So
how can you come to the conclusion that the jury found there was no violation of standard of care?
2 points, Your Honor. The first is I believe there's one other alternative. In other words, there could, A, be a no finding of liability under any of the statutory provisions. In other words, it was not a readily dischargeable firearm because it wasn't loaded at the time it was given to him, and he didn't give him any ammunition. The second is the excuse defense under the penal statutes themselves. And the third is the suicide defense. So I believe, to your point, I understand where the court's going with this question, but and to your point is we don't know whether or not the court found that there was no negligence on the part of Mr. Guilfoyle other than the fact that there is evidence to support that verdict. But the point is, that is not my burden, Your Honor. I am not here arguing that there was error. I'm here arguing the exact opposite. And it is the incumbent and it is the burden of the appellant to demonstrate to the court that there was probably, that there was error which probably resulted in the rendition of an improper judgment, and that they haven't done for precisely the reason, not that I say, but that the Supreme Court says in Alvarado, that the finding of no negligence on the part of the defendant means that there can't be error based upon the submission of the
We don't know that finding exists in this case. We don't know that the jury found no negligence because of the way that the question was submitted. How can we jump to that conclusion?
Well, I would say that we can say that there was a finding of no negligence because that's precisely what the charge says, and that's precisely what the verdict says.
The charge says then you consider the defense. So even if they found negligence, they could have said, but he committed suicide.
I agree with Your Honor that there is a possibility that the jury could have relied exclusively on the suicide instruction, which, again, was entirely proper to have been given, entirely proper to be given, was the reason for a no answer on the liability finding as to Mr. Guilfoyle. That is absolutely true. But the reason, Your Honor, that I would respond to the court's question is, how can we say that that's not reversible error? I would say respectfully, it's not me saying it. It's not my client saying it. It's not Judge McCoy saying it. It's the Supreme Court of Texas saying it in Alvarado. So I don't believe that they can meet their burden in this instance as it applies to whether or not that submission. But again, I think we're getting to the eighth issue down the road, if you will, rather than the first issue down the road, which is whether or not there was evidence of suicide in this case. And I believe we have a pretty wide gulf in our view of the evidentiary record as to whether or not there was evidence of suicide in this record. So actually there were two people who testified it was suicide. The two people that lived with Sam, not some stranger from the outside, but two people, his stepfather and Mr. Newby, Scott Newby, who lived in the house as well, who actually found Sam. And his testimony was, let's talk about Peter's testimony first. It's cited on page 17 of our brief, and specifically Mr. Dobbs testifies that on Wednesday, it was the day that he shot himself, and then he goes through the reasons of what was going on in his personal life and his relationship of what was going on with his mother. Mr. Newby's testimony that he thought Sam committed suicide based upon what he found is page, volume 4, reporter's record, pages 29 and 30, and page 52. Again, Peter, the stepfather's testimony, do you have an opinion as to what happened that night with Sam? In my opinion, again, this is all evidence, testimony that went to the jury. Unobjected to evidence that went to the jury, and we're not here on a review of that evidence. In my opinion, he committed suicide. He was playing Russian roulette or one of the two. And what do you base that opinion on? On the biopsy, you meant autopsy, obviously, or where the bullet was placed? And I've spoken with a couple of doctor friends as well. And again, he goes on, and we cite it. It comes from page 4 of the reporter's record, page 57 and 58. Again, the idea that there's no evidence of suicide in the record simply is not accurate. And we ask the court to affirm the trial court's judgment in all respect.
Thank you, Mr. Alvey. Mr. Webbo.
Just to touch on a couple of things. Number one, there was no evidence at all this child had ever handled a handgun before. The evidence was clear that all of his hunting he did with his dad, under his dad's supervision, all with rifles and shotguns. And in fact, his dad specifically says handguns were prohibited in their house. There's no evidence he had any prior issue with handguns. And I think to address one of the questions you had, you know, I think when you read the jury question that came out from the jury, it's pretty clear that they're struggling with what is this, because they basically like, what's the difference between 1 and 2? And 1's the negligent standard of care, and 2's the negligence per se. And so I think that goes to the issue of, ties into this Alvarado issue, which was those questions. There was 1, which was just negligence, didn't have the instruction, then 2 did. And the court in Alvarado actually didn't overturn the Court of Appeals on that issue. What they said is, we're not going to get there, because we're not going to even have to address this instruction issue. That's different than here, where the instruction is both in question 1 and question 2. And so there's a difference there. And then finally, just to address the issue on Peter Dobbs, you know, if that's the testimony, if it's his conclusion that it's suicide, then actually his testimony said, well, it was suicide or Russian roulette or whatever it was, which is whether he's playing with a gun or whether he pulls the trigger. Either one, we don't get there if this gentleman doesn't bring this handgun over. And finally, I would just ask the court to go through this record, and I know you will, but this is a gentleman who brought a handgun and gave it to a child, and he saw him putting bullets and playing with it. There's just no way you can come to some conclusion that that's not negligence unless you buy into this, well, we think he may have committed suicide, because the defense lawyer made that argument. I just don't think the common sense gets there. There's no way you ought to be giving handguns to children and watching them play with bullets.
And the autopsy report or finding was inconclusive, is that correct?
Yes. What they do is they put, you know, homicide, suicide, whatever, and at the cause, they did not find the cause of suicide because, well, they go through the rationale, but basically when we talked to them, basically said, listen, we see suicide, somebody puts their gun to the head and does this, and there's this. The way the angle was and the barrel was further away, so that's why we couldn't come to the conclusion that was a suicide. And that's what they find in their report.
And that was admitted at trial, right?
Yes.
Along with expert testimony supporting that?
Just the report itself, yes.
Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bobo. Mr. Ave, thank you for your arguments today and all your briefing for submission today. Your case is now submitted and you are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll call the second case, which